Hey there, ACRAC listeners. I am excited to announce that I will be speaking at the Aspen Anesthesia Seminar. That's from February 1st to 8th, 2025 at the Viceroy Snowmass Resort in Snowmass, Colorado, that's put on by Holiday Seminars. This is a fantastic organization that puts on CME seminars in beautiful locations, and they do a really, really great job of having amazing speakers and putting on a great show for everyone who's going to come. So I highly encourage you, if you're looking for a place to go, do some skiing and get great CME, check it out. You can go to holidayseminars.com. You can register there as well as learn more information about it. And if you choose to come, you'll have me there as well as some other amazing speakers throughout the course of the week. I hope to see some of you there.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. By honoring your sacred vocation of education, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. At Grand Canyon University, our online bachelor's, master's, and doctoral education degree programs allow you to balance online coursework with observational and hands-on experience in the field. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am really excited today, more than usual, because I have a new guest and one who was recently one of my residents, is now in a month where he's doing some attending time before he starts his fellowship, and then will be a cardiac anesthesia fellow here with us, but is just a fabulous person. He was one of my chief residents, is amazing in so many ways, and he is coming on to do a keyword episode. Now, I do want to say that anytime we do a keyword episode these days, we always, of course, are doing this, remembering Jillian and keeping her in our hearts and minds and knowing that this was something that she would want us to continue doing. And so I am really thrilled to welcome Dr. Tim Kaitura to the show to do a keyword episode on both ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, and transfusion reactions. Those are the two keywords we'll talk about today. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jed. It's such a pleasure to be here. And like you said, always thinking about Jillian whenever I do any kind of test prep. Back from when I was a medical student and interviewing and all throughout my time in residency, she was always my go-to person to talk about any test prep issues, how to approach questions, how to think about studying as an adult learner. So it's great to be here in her memory and doing this with you.
Fabulous. All right. So we're going to talk about both the two keywords of ECT and then transfusion reactions. So should we start with ECT and you can get us started?
Yeah, we'll do ECT first. That falls in the advanced topics on our ABA keyword list. And it's under special problems in or issues in anesthesiology. And all it says in those keywords is electroconvulsive therapy. So it doesn't really give us any specifics or further information on what we need to know in detail. But looking through all of the questions in the tests I've taken, there's generally two things that get tested, two big categories. The first is the physiological response to ECT. And the second is anesthetic considerations. And then there's plenty of overlap with other topics where you might see it come up. For instance, you might have a question about non-OR anesthesia guidelines, and the setting is an ECT suite somewhere. And then you might be asked about having backup power supply or having an MH kit available using triggering agents, things like that. But we'll cover those bigger categories that I think are more specific to ECT, and we'll do the physiological response first. And there's really one key concept that I want you to know, and that's ECT induces a generalized motor seizure and an acute cardiovascular response that is characterized by initial parasympathetic discharge followed by a slightly longer sympathetic discharge. Do you want to dive right into questions and see if we can get that down?
Let's do some questions. I love it.
All right. So the first question, you induce anesthesia for a patient undergoing ECT treatment for major depression. What is the most common autonomic nervous system response following seizure onset? A, initial bradycardia followed by tachycardia and hypertension. B, initial tachycardia followed by bradycardia and hypotension. Or C, initial bradycardia with a return to baseline.
Yeah, it's a great question. I feel like I've definitely seen a version of this question on tests that I've taken and on some of the MoCA questions that come through. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if folks see this in some form. And so as you said, Tim, what we get with ECT is usually an initial parasympathetic discharge followed by a sympathetic discharge. And so hopefully that keys people into realizing that A is going to be the right answer here. That initial parasympathetic discharge will give you some bradycardia, and then you will, after that, have some tachycardia and hypertension. And I think it's clear why the other ones are incorrect.
Exactly. And I think that's spot on. And like you said, you see this question in a few different ways, and we'll see it in a couple of other ways in our upcoming questions. And this is, I think, the simplest the way they can ask it. It's simply just regurgitating what we said in key concept one. Do you know that it's parasympathetic followed by sympathetic? I also want to point out at this point that all of the questions we'll have today will only have three answer stems, because that's what the ABA has moved to for all of their exams. The ITE, the basic, the advanced, they're all just three choices now. So all of our questions will have those three choices. And you've talked previously on the keyword episodes about how we're not really seeing questions anymore that say all of them except, or a lot of negatives that you have to worry about. But I'm still seeing questions that have both maybe ask about the most or the least. So we'll see some of both of those types of questions as well.
Yeah, that's great. And I think, Tim, that what they're really trying to avoid are the kind of double negatives where you end up having to, you know, they don't want people to get the answer wrong because they knew the right answer but couldn't figure out, you know, the double negative. So I think that's what they're trying to avoid.
Absolutely. All right. Second question. You are called to the recovery unit to see a patient who received ECT treatment 10 minutes prior. On your assessment, they're experiencing an exaggerated response of the typical hemodynamic changes associated with ECT. Which of the following medications would be an appropriate treatment at this time? A, atropine, B, phenylephrine, or C, labetalol?
Great. And so, like you said, this is now taking it a step further. You have to make the connection that the typical response is that post bradycardia, tachycardia, and hypertension. So you gave us in the question stem there that it's 10 minutes after. So you have to make that connection in your mind. They're past the parasympathetic stage. And now what we're seeing is the hypertension, tachycardia. So if you know that, then the next piece you need to know, of course, is how to treat that. Hopefully, this one is pretty straightforward. Atropine, of course, will cause tachycardia. Phenylephrine will cause hypertension. So we don't want either of those. And that leaves us with labetalol, which people should know is both an alpha and a beta blocker. So it will do both. It will reduce blood pressure and it will reduce heart rate. And so, of course, a great option for this case.
Beautiful. And question number three, a patient with MEN2A syndrome also has medication resistant major depressive disorder and is being evaluated for electroconvulsive therapy. Which of the following syndrome manifestations would be a contraindication to therapy? A, theochromocytoma, B, medullary thyroid cancer, or C, parathyroid gland cancer?
Great. And so, again, this is a great question for practice because you could easily get thrown off. When they mention MEN2A, you could start kind of trying to remember all of the things that go along with that syndrome and kind of getting flustered there, which is a great reminder just from a test-taking skill standpoint that before you get into all the details of the whole long question stem, look at what they're asking, right? And so what they're asking here is just, what's a contraindication to ECT therapy? So don't worry about everything that has to go with MEN2A. Just look at that and then look at the answer choices and then go back to the stem if you need to get more information. And here, if you just know they're looking for contraindications to ECT therapy, and if you remember that, you know, ECT can cause that hypertension and tachycardia after the initial parasympathetic discharge, then hopefully you can already answer the question that pheochromocytoma is going to be the contraindication. Because if you already have a pheo, which can cause discharge of catechols, cause hypertension and tachycardia, then you don't want to exacerbate that. The others, cancer is not a contraindication.
Perfect. I think that's absolutely right. That's the best way to approach these types of questions, and certainly the right answer here. I think it's a great question also because you could get caught up if you don't know about the exaggerated sympathetic response to ECT, you might get stuck on medullary thyroid cancer and think about parathyroid gland cancer and whether, you know, swelling of the neck and things like that could be a contraindication. But the more obvious of those three is certainly FEO.
Right.
Okay, so we'll move on to the anesthetic considerations. So amnesia is only required for a brief period of time, and paralysis is useful to decrease risk of fracture associated with ECT. So the goal is to allow for an appropriate length seizure safely with quick recovery. And key concept two for us is going to be that most induction agents have anticonvulsant properties. Notable exceptions are etomidate, which is proconvulsant, and methohexital, unlike the other barbiturates, which lowers seizure threshold. Ketamine increases seizure duration, but can delay awakening and is associated with hallucinations. And remifentanil and alfentanil are useful adjuncts for reducing hypnotic induction doses for patients with high seizure thresholds, but they don't reliably cause amnesia alone. So the big takeaway points there is that really there's a limited handful of agents that are appropriate for ECT that reach those goals that we spoke about, and a couple of adjuncts that can be useful. A question to drive that home. Question four, you will be providing anesthesia for a patient who is undergoing electroconvulsive therapy, ECT. During the last ECT session, methohexital was used, but the seizure duration was inadequate. Which of the following medications would be the most appropriate induction agent for this session? A, etomidate, B, ketamine, or C, propofol?
Yeah, and this, I will say, I have seen in real life, so I've absolutely seen this exact scenario in real life where the psychiatrist says, you know, listen, the seizure wasn't long enough last time with methohexital, let's pick something different, and I've seen it on tests. So this is very high yield. And so the answer here, as you mentioned up front, is etomidate, because etomidate is proconvulsant, it'll help you have a longer seizure. Ketamine probably would work, but again, would have a lot of side effects, so not the best choice. And propofol, of course, would make it less likely that you'd have a seizure, so you don't want that.
Right. And I'll point out also that propofol isn't a completely unreasonable choice for ECT because it does reach some of the other things we need. It's fast on, fast off, doesn't cause a lot of confusion with wake up, things like that. But in this setting certainly wouldn't lengthen your seizure compared to methohexital. Question five, a patient undergoing electroconvulsive therapy, ECT, has been noted to have decreasing seizure duration with each subsequent treatment. You decide to reduce the methohexital dose for this session to improve seizure duration. Which of the following medications would be the most appropriate induction adjunct? A, hydromorphone, B, remifentanil, or C, esmolol?
Yeah, great. So as you mentioned up front, fast-acting, potent opioids can be helpful as adjuncts to let you reduce the amount of induction agent you need. And so of these options, remifentanil is that agent. Hydromorphone, of course, or also known as Dilaudid in this country, is a much longer-acting opioid, and so not ideal for this situation. And esmolol, of course, is a fast-acting, short-duration beta blocker, which is not going to help with reducing the dose of methohexital that you need.
Right. And even if you're just totally in the weeds and lost on this one, you know, you should at least be able to knock esmolol off, remembering what our hemodynamic changes after seizure onset is, that esmolol probably isn't something you'd want to give with induction anyway, because it might exaggerate that initial bradycardia. So at least you'd be down to 50-50. And then if you know one's short-acting, one's long-acting, you could definitely get there without knowing this.
Perfect.
Question six, a middle-aged male returns for the next session of ongoing outpatient electroconvulsive therapy. His home medications include metoprolol, lorazepam, and occasional acetaminophen, which he took this morning. Which medication should be administered before inducing a seizure? A, N-acetylcysteine, B, glucagon, or C, flumazenil?
All right. So this is great because they're trying to throw you off a little bit, right? They give you the Tylenol. And so they make you think N-acetylcysteine. Are they getting a Tylenol toxicity? But really, if you think about what the point of an ECT session is to have a seizure. If you just took lorazepam, that's hopefully we all know that benzos are, with the exception of methohexital, are anti-seizure. And so that's going to make it hard. And so giving something to reverse the action of that Ativan, and the reversal agent for benzos is flumazenil, is going to be helpful. Glucagon doesn't really have a role here.
Exactly. I think it's just a third reversal agent if you're thinking about potential beta blocker toxicity or something like that, but definitely right. A red herring there.
And that's interesting, actually, Tim, right? Because they may be trying to trip you up there too, thinking, oh, you took the metoprolol and you know about the initial bradycardic response to the ECT, but we rarely, I mean, glucagon is given in the setting of beta blocker overdose. It's not really I don't think of it so much as a reversal agent for beta blockers, mm-hmm. And you wouldn't give it in this setting.
Absolutely. All right. Anything else you'd like to cover about ECT, or should we move on to transfusion reactions?
I think we've covered the really high yield stuff. This is, you know, there's sort of a small subset of things that come up a lot, and I think you've hit it well. So let's move on.
All right. So transfusions reactions are going to be in the basic topics of our outline. They fall under the organ-based basic and clinical sciences in the hematologic system. And what we'll cover today are the reactions to transfusions and complications of transfusions. Under reactions to transfusions, we're told we need to know about febrile reactions, allergic reactions, and acute and delayed hemolytic reactions. And for complications of transfusions, they want us to know infections. They specifically list hepatitis, human immunodeficiency virus, cytomegalovirus, and they others, which are not specified by them. 2, citrate toxicity. 3, electrolyte and acid-base abnormalities. 4, massive transfusion, which for them includes coagulopathies and hypothermia. 5, the pulmonary complications, transfusion-related acute lung injury and transfusion-related circulatory overload, and then immunosuppression. So we'll start with the reactions to transfusions. Key concept 1 is going to be that febrile reactions, also known as non-hemolytic transfusion reactions, and I've seen this written both ways on test and study materials, are caused by recipient antibodies to donor leukocytes. Therefore, leukoreduction can help reduce this complication. Key concept 2, urticarial reactions, which are non-febrile as well, and result in hives, erythema, are due to recipient antibodies to transfused plasma proteins and should be treated with antihistamines and steroids. So the big difference there is that it's recipient antibodies to donor leukocytes for febrile reactions, and the erythematous itching reactions are to recipient antibodies to plasma proteins. And then the third key concept here is that anaphylactic reactions are mediated by recipient anti-IgA antibodies against IgA-containing blood transfusions. And these are most common in IgA-deficient patients who should only receive washed packed blood cells to prevent this.
And Tim, just so everyone is on the same page, when we say anaphylactic reactions, we are not talking about acute hemolytic transfusion reactions. I think a lot of people hear anaphylactic and think that's the worst one. But those are different things. And I know you're going to get to hemolytic transfusion reactions in the next key concept. So here, when you say anaphylactic reaction, you're talking about this IgA-mediated antibody against the IgA-containing blood transfusion.
Absolutely. Anaphylactic in the same sense that you can have an anaphylactic reaction to penicillins or rocuronium, not anaphylactic as in a terrible reaction that can occur with like an ABO incompatible transfusion.
Great.
All right. Question number 1. A 50-year-old patient receives a packed red blood cell transfusion in a post-anesthesia care unit after an open colectomy. As the blood is infusing into a peripheral intravenous line, the patient notifies his nurse that he is itching on his chest and arms. He is hemodynamically stable. The antibody most likely responsible for this reaction is to A, Rh, B, MN, P, and Lewis, or C, none of the above.
So it sounds like this patient is having an urticarial type reaction, right? They're itchy. I don't think it tells us about a fever, but it doesn't say it. So, you know, we're going to assume this is just kind of itching on the chest and arms, sort of rash, non-febrile urticarial type reaction. As you told us up front, this is going to be due to recipient antibodies to transfused plasma proteins. Now, we didn't talk specifically about the type of antibodies, but you would kind of have to know that Rh antibodies are going to play a different role, as are some of these other various named and MNP, Lewis, Cal, these other antibodies. And so we'll get to that, but those are going to play a different role. And so it's none of these that is going to be responsible for this.
Exactly. So it's C, none of the above. And I think the other sort of testable thing here is they might ask you what to do about this. Like we said in the key concept, treatment with antihistamines and steroids helps with the symptoms of it. And this is actually something that you can safely continue transfusing during, though I totally understand if out of an abundance of caution until you're sure what kind of reaction this is, you might pause it for the meantime. But this is a safe reaction if you're convinced that it is what it is to continue transfusing through.
And do we know, Tim? I don't, but and if you don't, that's fine too. But do we know what antibody is responsible for this, that's attacking these plasma proteins?
I do not. Not off the top of my head.
And I'll tell you, I've never seen that asked on a test. I don't think they expect you to know that. So I wouldn't worry, go scrambling trying to find it, unless you just want to know for curiosity's sake.
Perfect. Question two. 40 minutes after transfusion of one unit of packed red blood cells, a 30-year-old man is experiencing chills and occasionally shivering. His temperature is 39.3, pulse is 87, and oxygen saturation is 95% on room air. He is given 1 gram of acetaminophen intravenously. 50 minutes later, he is no longer febrile, pulse is 80, and oxygen saturation is 99% on 2 liters nasal cannula. The most likely diagnosis is A, acute hemolytic reaction, B, febrile non-hemolytic reaction, and C, transfusion-associated circulatory overload.
So again, we'll get to the acute hemolytic reactions later, but they certainly don't behave like this, right? These are acute hemolytic reactions are major, sometimes fatal reactions, and so you don't get better in 10 minutes with a gram of Tylenol. So that this is clearly not that. And then transfusion-associated circulatory overload is in a setting of massive transfusion where you're just have essentially overloaded the circulatory system, which does, again, not make sense here for someone who got one unit of packed cells. So that leaves us with a febrile non-hemolytic reaction, which does fit since he did get febrile and it was relatively mild.
Exactly. And I think the only other place you could get tripped up a little bit is just if you over-focus on that oxygen saturation and think that there must be something happening in the pulmonary or cardiopulmonary system that's giving you a little bit of hypoxia. But 95% on room air after a surgery is something we very commonly see. And we often see these patients get put on oxygen, whether it's a little bit of nasal cannula or even a mask, just because someone's worried about that number because there are other symptoms going on as well.
Yeah, for sure.
Question number three, the removal of leukocytes from the transfused blood products, leukoreduction, is least likely to reduce the incidence of A, febrile transfusion reactions, B, cytomegalovirus infection, or C, allergic urticarial transfusion reactions.
So we have to think about what leukoreducing does, right? You're going to, as you said up front, you're going to be washing the cells and you're going to get rid of donor leukocytes, right? And so when we think about what that will reduce, it will reduce some febrile transfusion reactions because that is going to be, as you said again up front, Tim, that's going to be from reaction to the donor leukocytes. And if we wash those out, then that's going to be less likely. Cytomegalovirus infection, you'd have to know this, but that is an infection of the donor leukocytes. And so when you wash those out, you also are less likely to get the CMV infection. And so that leaves allergic urticarial transfusion reactions. And because those are, as you said, related to plasma proteins and not the plasma leukocytes, it's not going to help you with those.
Exactly. Anything else you'd like to mention about these reactions, transfusions, before we get onto the hemolytic side of things?
Yeah, no, I think this is a good coverage of the non-hemolytic ones. In my experience, the most likely ones to come up are the hemolytic, but I think it is good to know that there are these other ones and to have a reasonable knowledge of them, because these should be pretty easy points if they give you a question on these.
Exactly. Okay, a few key concepts. Key concept four, acute hemolytic reactions are characterized by rapid onset intravascular hemolysis, typically due to ABO incompatibility. Common causes are misidentification of a patient, the blood specimen, or of a transfused blood unit. As a result, autologous blood transfusion does not protect from this complication. Symptoms include tachycardia, hypotension, hemoglobinuria, can include bleeding, DIC, shock, kidney failure can rapidly develop. Like you've mentioned, these are severe reactions. Treatment involves stopping the transfusion, checking the unit, getting a full set of patient labs like coags, type and screen again, and then forced diuresis to protect the kidneys against the free hemoglobin. Key concept five. In contrast to the acute hemolytic reactions, delayed hemolytic reactions are generally mild extravascular hemolysis events secondary to antibodies against the non-D antigens of the Rh system or other systems such as the Kell, Duffy, or Kidd antigens. They occur 2 to 21 days after transfusion and can be confirmed with an anti-globulin Coombs test, which detects the presence of antibodies on the membrane of red cells, and treatment is supportive. So to hammer this home, the acute hemolytic reactions, that's ABO, they're immediate, and it's a rapid deterioration of the patient. The delayed hemolytic reactions are against the antibodies we've seen before, the Lewis, Kell, Duffy, Kidd antigens, non-D of the Rh systems. They're more mild and they happen later. And then we'll throw key concept 6 into here as well. Viral infections following blood transfusions are now rare. The highest risk is of hepatitis B at 1 in 200,000, while the risk for hep C and HIV is about 1 in 2 million, so 10 times less common. CMV transmission is possible through infected donor leukocytes, and this risk can therefore be mitigated by transfusing immunocompromised patients with leukoreduced blood products, something we saw in the last question we covered. However, bacterial contamination remains the second most common cause of transfusion-related mortality, with platelet transfusion carrying the highest risk at 1 to 25,000.
Right. And that's important because, and I think we will see this later, but you do get asked about the most common cause of mortality with transfusions. And so you want to be aware that while bacterial infection is up there, it's not number one. It's actually number two.
Okay. Question 4. Which of the following matching techniques, when applied to a platelet transfusion, would be most likely to prevent alloantibody-mediated hemolytic reactions in the recipient? A, ABO matching, B, extended phenotype matching, or C, RHD matching?
And this is a tricky one. It's key to realize here that they're asking you about preventing future antibody-mediated hemolytic reactions. In other words, what would prevent... or in this case, what would be most likely to prevent future development or future reactions? So what's going to prevent the patient, the recipient, from developing antibodies that in the future could react against a transfusion? And so the first option is ABO, and you have to know those exist in us whether we get, you know, we don't need to have them triggered. Those are going to exist anyway. And so if I am an O patient with O blood, I'm going to have anti-A and anti-B antibodies just in me naturally. So it's not going to give, you don't need to worry about those getting triggered because they're already there. B is extended phenotype matching. And I'm actually not 100% sure what that is. So I'm going to let you explain if you know, Tim, but I think that's less, not something I associate with this. And then Rh matching, this is something that hopefully we've all heard about. We know that, for example, if a woman is pregnant and she has a baby who is Rh positive, she can get the development of antibodies. So if she gets a future blood transfusion, then she can react against, if she's Rh negative, she can react against those Rh positive cells. And so if you can Rh match and not get any Rh positive cells in there, then you can help prevent the development of those alloantibodies. So I think Rh matching is probably the answer. Stay with us. We'll be right back. All right, and we're back.
Yeah, Rh matching is definitely the answer here. And I'm not the expert to talk about extended phenotype matching or the differences between antibody screens and extended phenotype matching. But for the reasons you mentioned, because there are some red cells in the platelets, and if you have Rh positive units and are exposed to Rh and you haven't been before, you can create antibodies to that and get hemolytic reactions. That's the, will be the more correct choice in this case.
Right.
Question 5, the rate of clinically significant hemolytic transfusion reaction as a result of administration of type specific blood is less than A, 1 in 250, B, 1 in 1,000, or C, 1 in 10,000.
And I think one of the key things here is they're not saying that it's been typed and crossed. It's just type specific. In other words, this is that you know a patient is, you know, AB positive and you're giving them AB positive blood. And so if you do that, there's obviously it's not as good as actually crossing the blood against their plasma to make sure that it's safe. But it's better than nothing. And so that would put me probably somewhere in the middle. This is not something I would know off the top of my head, but I would say probably given if you feel like they're giving me three choices, a kind of a low, a middle, and a high, and I know that we're kind of doing something, but not everything that can be done, I would probably guess the middle. So I would go with 1 in 1,000 here.
Yeah, 1 in 1,000 is the right answer. And it's absolutely a number I did not know off the top of my head either. But I think it's a great question because it points out the things that you said, that the other thing we need to have an understanding here is what steps we're taking to make sure that we're avoiding hemolytic transfusion reactions. The least you can do is a type specific. So you get your ABO and your presence or absence of RH correct. You're a little safer if you type in screen. So you check for those kid, Lewis, all of those minor but common antibodies. And the best if you actually cross match. And I think your approach to, if you're not sure what the number is, but you've sort of at least been able to bucket what the risk is, guessing somewhere in the middle is probably right. That's also not to say that the risk of it, if you don't type and type your blood, is 250. And in this specific case, however, the 1 in 10,000 is the correct number for if you do type and screen.
Right.
Okay. 6, what transfusion reaction does a positive direct antiglobulin Coombs test confirm? A, hemolytic reaction, B, non-hemolytic reaction, or C, anaphylactoid?
I think this is just one of those things you have to know. And so a direct antiglobulin test is going to confirm a hemolytic reaction.
Exactly. And here it's vague. It's not saying acute hemolytic. It's not saying delayed hemolytic. It's just hemolytic. You have antibodies against the red blood cells that tag them for destruction. You get hemolysis. Exactly. Question 7. A patient received an epidural 3 days ago for an open laparotomy for colon resection. Rounding on the acute pain service, you notice that she is jaundiced. Her hemoglobin is 7 milligrams per deciliter and her temperature is 38.2 Celsius. She's hemodynamically stable and appears well. On chart review, she received a unit of PRBCs intraoperatively and EBL was 500. You suspect she has a delayed hemolytic transfusion reaction. Which of the following statements is most likely true about this patient? A, she received an ABO incompatible. She received ABO incompatible blood. B, the blood bank failed to detect antibodies. Or C, this patient is bleeding and needs to go to the OR.
Yeah, this is a good question. So there's things that can throw you off here, right? Her hemoglobin is 7. So, you know, that may just jump out at you and you might think, uh-oh, she's bleeding, needs to go to the OR. But they also give you the fact that EBL was only 500 and that she's jaundiced, right? So you don't get jaundiced from bleeding. So you need to throw those things together and it should push you away a little bit from bleeding and needs to go to the OR. If it was an ABO incompatible acute hemolytic reaction, she would be much sicker than they're describing her in this, as we've already talked about. So that leaves you with the fact that this is probably a delayed hemolytic reaction extravascularly, where you're getting jaundice and the blood bank must then have failed to detect not the ABO type, but some of those other antibodies that can react.
Exactly. We also are given the fact that it's 3 days ago, which is your very other clear sort of distinction between the delayed and the acute, even if you're not sure if, you know, this temperature and hemoglobin is someone that's really sick or not. But I agree with your assessment that this isn't painting a picture of someone who's very acutely ill. And I think the other reason I really like this question is B just sounds like you're blaming someone. And sometimes it feels wrong to select the question that says, you know, the blood bank failed to detect antibodies, like it's something they didn't do and were supposed to. But this isn't an error. There's the ABO testing and the RH system testing, and then there's an antibody screen. But that antibody screen can't check every antibody that might exist. There are some things that are so rare that it's not clinically significant or worthwhile testing for every patient in every transfusion. And especially patients that have gotten lots of transfusions can develop antibodies against some of these less common minor antigens.
Right. Totally agree.
Okay. A few more key concepts, and we're moving sort of into the area of pulmonary complications, massive transfusion complications, and we'll do some questions after this next set as well. Key concept 7, massive transfusion carries several risks in addition to the reactions and complications we've talked about. They include coagulopathy, which is most commonly due to dilutional thrombocytopenia, but can also represent dilution of coagulation factors or other pathophysiological states such as DIC. 2, citrate toxicity, which results in hypocalcemia. Be especially concerned in patients with hepatic failure and pediatric patients since citrate is metabolized by the liver. 3, hypothermia if resuscitative fluids aren't warmed. And 4, hyperkalemia as the extracellular concentration of potassium in stored blood increases with time. It typically is less than 4 milliequivalents per unit, but hyperkalemia can result with blood of any age if it is transfused at rates greater than 100 mLs per minute. So that key concept is really long, but I think it sort of puts together all of those subcategories that the ABA asks us to know about for massive transfusions. Anything you want to touch on that key concept? So it's pretty big before we hit a couple of shorter key concepts.
No, I think you've hit some really important things there. I mean, both clinically and for tests. Hypocalcemia, absolutely. We see that much more so with plasma, FFP, than with red cells, but absolutely can happen with red cells. We need to always be thinking about the potassium. Where this comes up sometimes clinically is, you know, let's say you have a patient, you send labs, and their potassium is, you know, 3.1, and you're deciding whether to get potassium. But you ask yourself, is this a patient who, you know, is likely to get a couple units of blood over the next few hours? You might want to leave it alone. Don't give them units of potassium and then follow up with units of blood, because it's probably going to resolve when they get the blood and have that extra potassium in there.
Absolutely. That's a really great point. Key concept 8, transfusion-related acute lung injury, trolley, results in acute hypoxia and non-cardiac pulmonary edema within 6 hours of blood product administration, secondary to activation of immune cells in the lungs. It is most common with FFP and platelets, but can occur with any blood product. Treatment is supportive, and unlike ARDS, it will resolve within a few days. And then key concept 9, transfusion-related circulatory overload, TACO, occurs when blood product transfusion rates are higher than the patient's cardiac output, usually in massive transfusion situations. Want to dive into some questions?
Let's do it.
Question 8, a transfusion-related acute lung injury reaction is suspected in a patient following transfusion of multiple blood product units in the OR during a complicated femoral osteosarcoma resection. Which of the following is least likely to be seen in this patient? A, fever. B, acute rise in neutrophil count. Or C, bilateral pulmonary infiltrates.
All right, so this is another, which is the least likely to be seen. So we're looking for what is not likely to be seen in a patient with trolley. And so certainly fever we can see. And the way to think about that is you're just getting a lot of irritation of the lungs. And so C is clearly something we see, bilateral pulmonary infiltrates. And anytime you get irritation of the gut or the lungs, something with a lot of surface area, you can get a febrile reaction to that. And so fever can happen. But acute rise in neutrophil count is less likely. This isn't an infection, and so that's less likely to occur.
Absolutely. And in fact, with trolley, it's a decrease in neutrophil count. A relative leukopenia is a common finding in trolley.
That's right. So even less, even more clear that that's the right answer.
Exactly. Question 9, the incidence of transfusion-related acute lung injury, trolley, would be least reduced by which of these measures? A, exclusion of female donors. B, leukocyte reduction. Or C, use of blood less than 14 days old.
Yeah, so this is tough. Leukocyte reduction, I don't think, I'm going to say right up front, I'm not 100% sure what the right answer is here, but I don't think that it's the trolley is caused by a reaction to donor leukocytes. And so I think that's probably not likely to make a difference. And so maybe the right answer here, use of blood less than 14 days old. Again, anytime blood gets older, you start getting more things leaking out of cells and probably more likely to have an irritating reaction to the body in general in the lungs. So I would probably think that is not the right answer because it probably is something that can cause trolley. And then exclusion of female donors. here's where we get into thinking about, is this connected to the RH and what we know about having had a baby? And I'll be honest, I'm not sure. So I would probably come down and be between A and B and then not be 100% sure and have to guess on the test.
Perfect. And if you guessed B, that leukocyte reduction would not do much for trolley, you'd be right. I think the other way to get here is thinking from what the test takers are trying to test and why they're putting other answers here. If you remember that leukocyte reduction does help in some of the other things we've looked at, like the febrile hemolytic reactions that are antibodies against those leukocyte donors. We're talking about CMV reactions and how those can be transmitted in leukocytes. Those help there. So you might say, well, that's the misleading answer and choose that and you'd get there. The reason exclusion of female donors helps is just from clear evidence that female donors and especially multiparous female donors have products in their blood that are more likely to trigger a trolley response. So one of the reasons that trolley is no longer the leading cause of mortality associated with blood transfusion and TACO has sort of overtaken it is because most plasma is collected from male donors for this reason. And then use of blood less than 14 days. It's sort of what you mentioned that the older the blood is, the more cytokines there are. That adds to that two hit hypothesis you need for the inflammation and activation of the lung immune response that causes trolley.
Fabulous.
Yeah, a tough question, but I think it hits on a lot of the things that we've had and how they can start sort of working together to make trickier questions. Question 10, the presence of recipient immunoglobulin A antibodies is most likely to increase which of the following? A, risk of allergic reaction. B, severity of delayed hemolytic reaction or immune extravascular reaction. And C, suspicion of a trolley reaction.
Right. All right. So again, it's most likely to increase. So IgA antibodies, what is it going to increase? And so if we go back to one of the prior key concepts and the fact that allergic reactions, those even anaphylactic reactions often are related to these IgA antibodies. So if you remember that, that's going to be probably the right answer here. The severity of a delayed hemolytic reaction. So again, that's not IgA mediated, and trolley also is not going to be IgA mediated. So we're left with A.
Exactly. Question 11, which of the following is the most common cause of mortality associated transfusion of blood products? A, trolley, B, non-ABO hemolytic transfusion reaction, or C, bacterial infection?
Right. So I kind of alluded to this earlier. The trick that some people fall for here is bacterial infection because it is the second most common cause, but it is not the most common. Trolley is actually the most common cause of mortality associated with blood products. And while hemolytic transfusion reactions are really bad, they are, thank goodness, not that common. And so they are not the leading cause.
Exactly. And I don't know how they'll be asking this question moving forward. And here it's purposefully stated as of the following, and it gives you three things. And trolley is more common than bacterial infection, or at least was at some point. Trolley has been decreasing recently as a common cause of mortality due to some of the things we mentioned in the previous question, using only male donors for FFP. And TACO has overtaken it. So if you had something, I think it would be an unfair question to be asked to choose between TACO and trolley, because the textbooks would still tell you it's trolley. The more recent literature would tell you it's TACO. So I don't think you'll get that exact comparison in questions recently. But if you're asked about timing, trolley is becoming less of a concern.
Great.
Question 12, a 21-year-old male is brought to the OR for surgical management of a complex lower extremity injury from a motor vehicle accident. His course in the ED was notable for hypovolemic shock on arrival there 45 minutes ago, and he was treated with transfusion of 6 units of PRBCs. On arrival to the OR, bleeding is well controlled with tourniquets, blood pressure is 100 over 62. You continue transfusion with blood products because the hemoglobin is 6.1. The patient begins exhibiting recurrence of hypotension. It's down to 76 over 46. EKG shows a new increase in your QT interval. CVP is up from 12 to 16. The most likely etiology of these physiologic disturbances is A, citrate toxicity, B, hyperkalemia, or C, tension pneumothorax.
All right. This is tricky because unfortunately you can't just read the last kind of line and go to the answers. You do in this one, and this happens sometimes where it's a long stem and you do need some of the information from the stem. And so what stands out in this stem? One thing is that he is pretty significantly hypotensive. Another is that he got a lot of transfusion. And another is that he has this increase in his QT interval and then an increase in his CVP. So what this is painting a picture of is somebody with some probably cardiogenic heart failure, cardiogenic shock, right? So his blood pressure is low, his CVP's up. Sounds like his heart isn't working as well as it was just recently. And then that QT, and again, you either know or you don't, but it's important to know that in hypocalcemia, the number one EKG finding is prolonged QT, is long QT. So we're putting that together and the fact that he got all this blood and he's now, his heart is hypotensive, his heart's not working as well, and he's got this long QT, you got to think hypocalcemia. And we already talked about how massive transfusion, blood products are going to, because of the citrate in them, they're going to eat up that calcium. And so citrate toxicity, that's the other tricky thing about this, is they don't give you hypocalcemia as an answer. So you have to pick up on the fact that what they mean by citrate toxicity is citrate binding calcium and therefore hypocalcemia. Hyperkalemia certainly can happen with lots of transfusion of blood products. We talked about that. But hyperkalemia shows peaked T waves, not a prolonged QT on the EKG, and wouldn't in and of itself cause hypotension unless it led to, of course, a cardiac arrest or arrhythmias, and they're not giving us that information. And then a tension pneumothorax, while always possible in a traumatic injury, they're not giving us anything about breath sounds or hypoxemia. And so, again, a little less likely, though that is tricky, and it certainly wouldn't cause QT prolongation.
Yeah, I think that was such an eloquent explanation of your thought process to this. It is a citrate toxicity. Could he be a little bit hyperkalemic? Sure. Could he have a tension pneumothorax now developing as well? Who knows? But it's certainly not the best answer. And you pointed out all the reasons why citrate toxicity should be really jumping out at you from that step. Question 13, which of the following would most provide evidence in support of transfusion-related acute lung injury following intraoperative administration of blood products in a patient who is now hypoxic in the PACU 5 hours after emergent right lower extremity ORIF? 1, elevated urine hemoglobin. 2, leukopenia. Or 3, a positive Coombs test.
All right. So this came up before in that leukopenia is characteristic of trolley. So we know that's likely elevated urine hemoglobin. So that's going to be more consistent with hemolysis, right? So you're going to have that free hemoglobin that you're going to urinate out. And a positive Coombs test, as we said, is going to be for hemolytic reaction. So the one that is most likely for trolley is going to be leukopenia.
Perfect. 14. Transfusion with which of the following blood products carries the highest risk of the recipient developing transfusion-related acute lung injury? A, fresh frozen plasma. B, apheresis platelets. Or C, prothrombin complex concentrate.
And this is a little tricky. I think in your key concept, Tim, you said that it's more likely with platelets and FFP, though it can happen with any blood product. PCCs, I would think, I guess I don't know this for sure, but I think are probably pretty unlikely given that they are a manufactured product. Between platelets and FFP, I generally think of FFP as being the higher risk for this, but both can cause it for sure. So if I had to pick, I'd go with A, fresh frozen plasma here.
And that's what I would go with as well. And this was the right answer here. If you put your feet to the fire, fresh frozen plasma is the thing that carries the highest risk of transfusion-related acute lung injury. And I won't beat this into the ground too much. But again, this might change a little bit given the changes in how we acquire plasma these days. Question 15, a 32-year-old female undergoes a planned cesarean section and hysterectomy under epidural with eventual conversion to GA. There is 2 liters of blood loss during the case, and she is resuscitated with transfusion of multiple blood products. In the recovery unit, she develops hypoxia. Which of the following would best support a diagnosis of transfusion-associated circulatory overload, TACO, rather than transfusion-related lung injury, TRALI? A, bilateral infiltrates on chest radiograph, B, hypotension, or C, jugular venous distension.
So again, you got to think about what these two things are. TACO being a volume overload and associated with all the things that you think of with volume overload, too much volume for the heart, and then TRALI being acute non-cardiac pulmonary edema. And so you definitely, with both of these, when you have heart failure, you can get bilateral infiltrates from obviously cardiogenic pulmonary edema. TRALI, you definitely get the infiltrates from the non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema. Hypotension, that's a little tricky because generally you think with cardiac failure of seeing hypotension, but you can, because of the inflammation from TRALI that can cause vasodilation, you can get hypotension as well. But jugular venous distension is really something that you're going to see much more with TACO because, again, of the circulatory overload than you will with TRALI. So C is probably the right answer here.
Exactly. A and B will not help you distinguish between these two. And C, you really shouldn't see in transfusion-related lung injury, and you would in transfusion-associated circulatory overload. And then our last question for the day is going to be question 16. You have just induced general anesthesia and placed lines in a patient undergoing kidney transplantation. You call the pharmacy to request the ordered immunosuppressants and are now told that due to concern for cross-contamination in the pharmacy, these medications will not be available to you for the case. Which of the following interventions would be most likely to increase graft survival in this setting? A, hyperventilation of the patient to an end tidal of 30. B, transfusion of 2 units of packed red blood cells. Or C, keeping the patient hypothermic.
I love this question because it reminds me, when I was a resident, one of the transplant anesthesia attendings asked me, or told me, I guess, about an old finding that when they first started doing transplants and they didn't have, you know, the immunosuppression, that they found that patients who got more blood transfusions during the transplant had better graft survival. And that, of course, is because blood transfusion itself can be an immunosuppressive. And so that's not good when it comes to like risk of infection. But for graft survival, it actually can help. We would never opt for this over our modern immunosuppressants, but this question is giving you a setting where they aren't available. So if you had to pick something, then of this question, this is what they're getting at you knowing. Hyperventilation isn't going to make a difference in keeping the patient hypothermic, while certainly keeping a kidney while it's outside the body, hypothermic is better than keeping it normal thermic. You know, you can't keep the patient frozen while you wait for immunosuppressants. So we're going to go with B here, transfusion of packed cells.
Perfect. And I had to stick this question before its key concept. Otherwise, we just wrecked the question. You got the reasoning perfectly. And our key concept 10 for today is that transfusion-related immunomodulation, or TRIM, refers to the immunosuppressive and pro-inflammatory response to allogenic transfusion of blood products. This may increase risk of infection, cancer occurrence, and mortality. But in kidney transplants, this immunosuppression can increase graft survival, the evidence that you talked about and led you to the right answer in question 16.
Fabulous. Well, Tim, great, great high yield couple of topics. And I think this will be really helpful for folks as they study. Plus, of course, in their clinical practice. Shall we move to the portion of the show where we make random recommendations?
I would love to do that.
Do you have a random recommendation to share with the audience? Something fun you'd recommend they check out?
I have two for you. One is the Lightbringer series by Brent Weeks. I have only read the first book so far, which is The Black Prism, but this came recommended to me from a friend. If you are into fantasy, that really dives into how, like the mechanism of magic or whatever sort of is unique to that universe works, this will really scratch your itch. It reminds me a lot of, Brandon Sanderson's Mistborn, and how I really love the alchemy in those, books. So I've been really enjoying that. The other thing I have to say, I don't think I can sit here and convince anyone to be a Formula One fan that isn't a Formula One fan, but I bet you I can find a few people that enjoyed it and kind of tuned out the last couple of seasons because they got tired of watching Max Verstappen win every race and Red Bull win the Constructors. And if you've been not following this season, it has picked up. It is not the kind of dominance you've seen before. I think we've had, in the first half of the season, already four different constructors out of the 10 and seven out of the 20 drivers win races. So it's a lot more competitive. It's exciting. We don't know what's going to happen by the end of the season. So if you've tuned out but enjoyed it in the past, it's a good season to tune back in.
Fabulous. Well, I will say I have read the Lightbringer books. I love them. I don't know if I ever mentioned them to you, or I may have even have shouted them out on this podcast before, but it's worth another one because I agree with you completely. They are fabulous. When I think of the great fantasy series, you know, of all time that I've enjoyed the most, I mean, certainly Sanderson's books, of course, Tolkien, Game of Thrones, although it breaks my heart that it's probably never going to be finished, but I really do put the Lightbringer series up there. I think it's fabulous. And I actually am going to recommend a book by Brandon Sanderson. So I've read all of his books. That's not right. I've read a lot of his books, and I've loved them. I am waiting for his Way of Kings series, the big his big kind of opus to be done before I, because I read the first four or five of them and loved them. And then, of course, he's not done with that series, so I'm waiting. I have no doubt he will finish it. He's finished. He's just such a prolific writer. I know that will get finished in time. But the Mistborn books, as you mentioned, were fabulous. And so I needed something else. Turns out his very first novel is called Elantris. And it's just a standalone novel. And I just finished it and I loved it. It's great. It's just, you know, it's interesting because it's clearly like a younger Sanderson, right? He's not quite as complex as he gets later in his writing, but it's still got all the brilliance of just a really well put together fantasy novel. And because it's a single, it's long, but it's a single book, so you can get through it. And it's really, it's well done. So I recommend checking out Elantris and Tim the Lightbringer. Fabulous. I have never watched Formula One in my life. But maybe one day I will check it out. Tim, thank you so much for coming on the show. This was great.
Thanks for having me so much, Chip.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrack.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast, and you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead, and Sophia Wu is our social media manager. William Mao is our production assistant. Thank you so much for the great work that you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.